Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. Once a month, always a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. And she comes prepared to talk about some things that are new and newsworthy in her field. So if you have questions about that, those are certainly welcome. But also it's the opportunity to talk about anything that falls within her area of practice. And we've talked about many different sorts of things on the show. So whatever's on your mind, I know she will do her best to answer your question. The only thing I always try to mention when we have physicians on the program is that I hope people who will call will understand that we cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are limits to what we can do on the show. If you have real concerns, you need to pursue that with your own physician or someone who can see you. And I also don't want to discourage anyone from calling by saying that. I just want to make sure people understand it. There is only so much that we can do in this format, but certainly your questions are welcome. And I know that the doctor will do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thank you once again for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
To start out, you suggest that maybe we might talk about some recent information that has to do with cancer and lifestyle. And of course, that's the kind of thing that shouldn't be any big surprise, you know.
Correct.
But again, it's probably worth talking about since we, in a lot of ways, cancer remains something of a mystery. And it would be better if we could to do what we can with prevention before we get around to actually having to treat it. So I guess anything that people could do along those lines to lower their risk, we'd have to say, well, this is a good thing.
Absolutely. And I think that I've been giving general statistics for a long time. There were studies that showed that thinner women had a 20% less likelihood of developing breast cancer than heavier women. And when you talk directly one-on-one with your own patients, most doctors say, well, you should diet and exercise, and all the patients are, yeah, right, doc. I know. Mm. And I think the other problem is that we weren't really able to look a patient in the eye and say how diet and exercise would help prevent a particular thing. And, you know, it's obvious if you just weigh less that you look better maybe. That might be a specific example of something positive that you could say to your patient. But in terms of cancer prevention, we used to just be able to say there were these epidemiologic studies that showed that. Well, now they're starting to work the biological aspects. In other words, try to figure out scientifically what would be changed in an individual if they actually exercised and lost weight. And with breast cancer as a specific example, we have now found that exercise and diet does a number of things that we can scientifically prove. We know that it reduces your intra-abdominal fat, so around the waist. And actually, that could be tested. There are sophisticated body fat percentage machines that they're actually the same machines that we do bone density on, can actually, if the right machine is used, get your intra-abdominal fat percentage. Well, it can calculate your fat percentage pretty much everywhere in your body. It also has now been shown that dieting reduces your testosterone for women, reduces your testosterone level, improves your fasting insulin level, and increases what's called SHBG, your sex hormone binding globulin, that would also actually reduce circulating hormone levels in your body. And it would be possible to do a blood test on a woman and then after dieting, and even as much as 5% weight loss, which isn't a lot for some people. So 5% is 5 pounds per 100, of course. And so a 200-pound woman would only need to decrease to 190, for instance, which is a pretty doable goal for many of us. And that is, these things have been shown to directly, therefore, then lower your risk of eventual development of breast cancer. The other thing that has been pretty exciting, in another research study, some investigators showed that you have decreased breast density when you exercise. And I know a lot of women who've out there gotten mammograms. Occasionally the report comes back, well, normal, but the breasts are very dense. And density, in the past, we used to tell patients, well, we know this is due to young age and to hormone use and a few other things like that. But we used to tell patients that just a dense breast in and of itself isn't a problem, but it might obscure a pre-existing cancer from being picked up on your mammogram. So we would recommend possibly other tests or at least not skipping your mammograms each year. And now the research has shown that women with more dense breasts actually are at increased risk for breast cancer, and that even as short a time as 6 weeks to 6 months of increased exercise has now been shown to lower breast density. So it's a way you can even improve not only your risk, but improve the ability for your mammogram to pick up that cancer, which is kind of exciting.
So that's just a couple more things to add to the long list of benefits of being at what's considered to be an ideal weight and getting some regular exercise. There's so many things that's true.
But I try to tell my patients, since so much of our population, so many of us out there are not quote unquote ideal weight. I think sometimes from where a particular individual sits to ideal weight, it's a big jump. And I think that these studies are showing that you start accruing benefits right away to exercising. Yes, also to eating right, which I haven't really discussed yet this morning, but we've certainly discussed a number of times, and also to the exercise, the eating right, and minimal amounts of weight loss, as well as eventually targeting a quote-unquote ideal. Mm-hmm. You don't have to even get to ideal, but, of course, that would be the most beneficial.
Yeah. We have a caller here ready to go, and I should introduce again our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at U of I School of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, on a Monday, she's here on the program, and we talk about women's health. So anything that you can think of, as long as it's what she deals with in her practice, you can call, and I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Howdy. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could tell us something about the difference between seasonal and Norplant.
Okay. Well, Norplant is a formerly available method of birth control, and it has only progesterone. The progesterone is levonorgestrel. The progesterone was delivered by a silicone rod system. In other words, there were six silicone rods that were implanted underneath the skin that would slowly release the levonorgestrel. They would primarily provide birth control by changing the cervical mucus so that sperm could not penetrate, so that its effectiveness for contraception was the first day you start on it, and or very soon thereafter. And eventually, many patients did not ovulate consistently on Norplant, but because it did not very consistently shut down ovulation, irregular bleeding and spotting were the number one side effects from Norplant. And because it had to be both surgically inserted and surgically removed, it made it a much more expensive alternative and less available for many women. And because the surgical removal was a little bit tricky, the rods developed a fibrous capsule around them pretty early on post-insertion, and that when practitioners would go to remove the rod 6 years later, if it was a physician doing the removal usually went very rapidly and smoothly. But if it was a nurse doing the removal who didn't typically do a lot of surgery, some of the removals were a little bit challenging for some practitioners. So that the cost-benefit for the company wasn't tremendous, and eventually it just went off the market. Similar rod systems are used worldwide. There are a couple of single-rod systems or a couple of double-rod systems, and one of which is even approved in the United States and has been since 1996, but it's never been manufactured nor marketed in the United States. So Norplant is a progesterone-only long-term steroid method. Seasonal is a continuous birth control pill, so that birth control pills generally are formulated such that there are 21 active pills and 7 inactive pills. And during those 7 inactive pills is when a woman would experience a shedding of the menstrual lining, and so she would call it a period. It isn't truly a period the way a natural cycle period might be. And it turns out that for many women, if you lengthen the number of days or weeks even in the active cycle pills, you can prolong the time between that bleeding withdrawal, so that the seasonal pill is packaged with 84 active pills and 7 inactive pills. So it's designed to have 4 of these withdrawal episodes per year. It's otherwise a fairly traditional contraceptive pill, and it has both estrogen and progesterone in it. So it's a little bit different.
Does that answer the question?
I assume so.
Okay, very good. Well, other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is something that we've talked about before on the program, the fact that there is no particular reason why a woman should have to have a period every month, and that by using the birth control pills in this way, lengthening out the cycles between the bleeding events, which, as you say, women, I think, would think it's technically not a period, but they would
right.
think of that as a period. And so that basically you used to have 4 periods a year. There are actually in a number of cases, there's benefits to doing that. Do you think that this is something that we will start to see more and more women do?
Well, absolutely. I think there are a couple of things. When birth control pills first came out, one of the reasons they were designed with a regular withdrawal bleed is it was there were no available pregnancy tests over the counter or anything like that, and women were more comfortable with that signal of bleeding to make them convinced that their pills were working and, in fact, I'm not pregnant. Mm. Well, it turns out that the birth control pills that were manufactured at that time were not only good at preventing pregnancy, they were fabulous. And in fact, you could reduce out of the birth control pill almost 98% of the hormone, which is what the levels are now relative to what they were, and still have them be extremely effective for prevention of pregnancy. So that I think we've gotten to the point where we don't need that hormonal, that body signal to say we're not pregnant. And I think that helps women be more comfortable. Also, when we look back in previous times, women had more pregnancies, they breastfed longer, they didn't live as long, and there were probably some nutritional factors as well. In past times, women actually had many fewer periods than modern women have today. And we think that, in fact, that is the more natural state than the once-a-month withdrawal bleed that people will have if they're not pregnant, not breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. So I think that has given us impetus to go the other way. We've always had the ability to write a prescription for a regular birth control pill that's packaged 21/7 and instruct our patients just to ignore those 7 pills or piggyback 2 cycles or piggyback 3 cycles or 4 cycles. But that's complicated for someone who is trying to just take their pill every day and be regular about it. It's also a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling not going with the package insert. So that the impetus behind Seasonal was to more formalize what doctors and patients were doing together and have a product that was exactly packaged that way and had patient literature that explained long cycle contraceptive use. And actually, there are some market estimates that say that about 50% of birth control pill users will be on long cycle pills fairly short. Seasonal was launched literally a few days ago. I think mm-hmm. it was mid-November, early November, something like that. And so really a lot of patients haven't had a chance to hear about it or try it.
Okay. We have another caller. This is someone in Champaign on line 2. Hello.
Good morning. I just have 2 quick questions. Mm-hmm. One would be, could you talk a little bit about causes and treatments for recurrent bacterial infections? And then on the other completely unrelated question is, could you talk about any of the new treatments for excessive, like facial hair? I've seen there's some new prescription creams, I think it was, for facial hair for women.
In terms of bacterial vaginosis, actually, there's been a lot of exciting research. There's one new study looking at the epidemiology of bacterial vaginosis, and we're finding out that it's a lot more common than what we thought. And also the message that the researchers wanted to get out to physicians, which, like, this study I just read a few days ago, so I'm not even sure how well the information is disseminated. But the other factor is that many more patients than we thought are what we call asymptomatic. So, in other words, they do have bacterial vaginosis, but unless you actually culture for it at the time of a regular checkup, it might be missed. And probably it's this subclinical group that doesn't really get diagnosed and is either then self-treating for yeast infections, or maybe the condition itself is waxing and waning, so it's got symptoms some of the time and not other of the time, that produces more of these recurrences. In general, we think that it may be related to host immune factors or local bacterial factors, so that, for instance, the normal healthy bacteria of the vagina that normally overgrow and produce lactic acid, if they are knocked down in numbers, then these other anaerobic type bacteria can flourish, and they tend to produce that characteristic odor and some of the discomfort and itching, and can eventually lead to discharge as well. So I think that the causes are imbalance in the vaginal flora, the natural vaginal flora, and an imbalance can be caused by a lot of things. It can be caused by exposures to condoms. It can be caused by frequent intercourse. It can be caused by being certain dietary factors. It can be caused by taking a round of antibiotics that knocked out the normal flora. So there are a lot of causes. And also now we know one of the other problems is that many more women than we realize have an asymptomatic infection that should be evaluated more frequently. Now, how we're going to do that with testing and so forth with more patients is probably not 100% clear, but for people with more minimal symptoms, it definitely they should be tested.
Is it effective to take, I've seen the supplements in the store, the pills that you can take. It says on there it restores
They haven't done a lot of studies with bacterial vaginosis with them. They've done a couple that looked pretty good, but definitely those supplements reduce your yeast infection rate and are definitely helpful for anybody that has had any kind of recurrent discomfort. And they're very safe.
Okay.
You can't go wrong with them.
You can't.
It costs a little bit of money, but
okay.
Otherwise there's literally no side effects.
Okay. And then could you talk a little bit? I can't remember the name of it.
Well, there have been a couple. The product that's been available the longest time is something called Vanquia, and it is a prescription face removal cream. Removing of hair is difficult. It can be tackled a few different ways. One, any hormonal impetus within your own individual body that is causing excess hair growth could be counterbalanced. The second way is just physical removal of the hair follicles, which is what the things like electrolysis do. The third way is sort of like electrolysis, but the laser kinds of treatments that also target the hair follicle, but they don't seem to do as complete a removal as electrolysis. They are less painful. But all that is in the category of removing. You can pluck it out as well, of course. Now, then there's these localized creams that have been tried, and some of them have a direct effect on the hair follicle, and some of them have a hormonal effect. And off the top of my head, I don't remember what the mechanism of action of Vanquia is supposed to be. But it does seem to work, and it seems to be a good product, and the incidence of local irritation seems to be very low. And it's definitely something women can try. It's probably best at more modest growths of facial hair. If somebody truly has a fairly thick mustache or beard, really electrolysis is probably going to have to be part of what they do.
Is that pretty effective? I mean, I haven't really known anyone that's done that.
It is very effective. It's very uncomfortable. Some people like to go to their physician and get a prescription for a local anesthetic type of lotion that can help during the procedure itself, because typically it's done in hair salons and they don't have the ability to write a prescription for that. Mm-hmm. But it is very effective.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On again to another caller. This is back in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I understand that there are some women who have a very heavy flow at their period, and it can be very debilitating, and I was wondering if there's any medication or if a D&C would help that or what could help that.
Well, let me start with the D&C. That doesn't help. D&C, for those of people who know, it is called a dilatation and curettage.
Mm-hmm.
And that curettage is just the dilatation part's just being able to open the cervix and get an instrument inside the uterus, and the curettage is just a scraping out of the lining. And since we're designed to shed our lining and completely regrow it, that physical scraping of the lining really doesn't do anything fundamental to change whatever was going on medically to cure the problem. Now, occasionally a woman might have a polyp or something like that that the D&C happened to remove, and in those cases it might help for a little while, but typically whatever process was set in motion with the polyps might return. Now, hysteroscopies, a surgery where a surgeon physically looks inside the uterus and actually operates to either remove a polyp or remove a type of fibroid, those can be curative of certain kinds of heavy bleeding disorders. Now, there are also a wide variety of problems causing heavy bleeding at the time of menstrual periods, and the biggest category is called dysfunctional uterine bleeding, means that there's no real explanation. You're just bleeding heavily, more heavily than everyone else. And usually that's a diagnosis by what we call exclusion. In other words, we look for causes that we can pinpoint. We don't pinpoint it. You wind up with a diagnosis of dysfunctional uterine bleeding. And that's more common in younger individuals. There are also certain bleeding diathesis. That's the fancy word meaning that there's something about your blood clotting system that's not allowing your blood to clot properly, and actually heavy bleeding can be part of that. And conditions like taking too much aspirin can be a cause of that, but there are things that people are born with, and von Willebrand's seems to be one kind of genetic inherited.
What was that word?
It's called von Willebrand's disease. It's a factor 8 deficiency, I think. They're one of the factor deficiencies, but it's called von Willebrand's disease and can be detected by a blood test. May be wrong on that factor number. But there are other kinds of conditions like uterine fibroids, which I alluded to, that are a very common cause, or polyps. It can be not due to the uterus at all. It can be due to the hormones or the condition of the ovary. So there are some women with ovarian conditions that need to be treated that would change the heavy periods. And usually workup of heavy menstrual periods is something that a typical primary care doctor or a gynecologist would be very familiar with. There are some basic tests which would usually involve a pelvic exam, possibly a pap smear if you're not current on that. Might be worth getting some cultures for infection if there was any suspected infection problem. Then usually some basic blood work to see whether or not the heavy bleeding is translating into enough blood loss that's causing you to be anemic. And then an ultrasound to look for polyps or fibroids or ovarian cysts, so that those are usually the basic tests. Then beyond that, if the basic problems aren't found to be the cause, sometimes some of these tests for the less common blood disorders and things like that are indicated.
You mentioned anemia. Could it be the cause of the anemia be the cause?
Most likely anemia is not the cause but the result. And we defined some of these problems by the fact whether or not the patient is anemic. Now, if you're taking a lot of iron and keeping up with the blood loss, then it's probably a different story. But definitely anemia can make you feel very poorly, and it's important. It's an easy diagnosis to make, an important diagnosis. There are some thyroid conditions or other hormonal conditions that can cause it as well.
Can birth control pills, are they ever prescribed to help this condition?
very often they're prescribed to help this condition because they work in a way that the lining tissue is relatively thinned out, and they can be given, as we were referring to earlier, in a way to space the periods out so you don't even have the period as often.
Yeah.
And so, yes, they're very effective treatment, but the recommendation is to have a diagnosis first before the treatment.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have, again, someone here, I think another caller on our line number two. We will go there. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like you to speak to the point of a young girl, 16-year-old, using a birth control pill to squelch acne. Like, what would be the dosage and or things that we need to think about to get this done? And I'm on the cell phone, so I'm going to have to hang up, but that's my question.
Okay.
We know that virtually all birth control pills on the market are fairly effective for helping to improve acne. We think that some birth control pills might be more effective than others. But the most likely physiologic way that the birth control pills control the acne are two. Number one, they are designed such to shut down the natural production of the ovarian hormones, and since a lot of the circulating male hormone testosterone comes from the ovary itself, by decreasing the ovarian production of hormones, we just make less testosterone. And two, the birth control pills, particularly the estrogen component in typical birth control pills, is designed to affect or because of the estrogen in it, does slightly affect the liver. And the liver is one place where we produce substances called globulins. And what I was referring to earlier in the show, SHBG, it's called sex hormone binding globulin, but that's why we call it SHBG. So much easier to say. And this is a globulin produced in the liver that binds testosterone. And we think that it's testosterone that becomes available to the skin that then gets locally converted into something called dihydrotestosterone, and that's what causes acne. There are probably other causes as well. We know that you got to wash your face and a couple of basic things. But with a lot less circulating testosterone, the acne does improve. And they've done some actual studies on the birth control pills, ortho-tricycline and ortho-tricycline low. They've looked at that. And the birth control pill Estrastep has specifically looked at that. There have been other studies with some of the other products out there. But those are the pills that I mentioned are the pills that have it in their package insert that they have done studies specifically looking at the control of acne with these pills, and it does work, and it's very safe for a teenager to use, and we always recommend starting with a low-dose pill, and both of the pills that I've mentioned are extremely low-dose, and it is something that a young girl would not necessarily have to have a pelvic exam just to start on pills to control her acne, and would be something good to discuss with your primary care doctor.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. This is our monthly program on women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign, and monthly on a Monday she's here. We talk about women's health. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Can I just, I wonder if we go back just for a second to the question of seasonal and this kind of pill use. I think the first time I remember us talking about that, what I remember was that it was as a way of helping women who had premenstrual syndrome. Because you have fewer periods, you deal with this kind of hormonal fluctuation, so you can reduce symptoms. I guess what I'm wondering about is, other than convenience, other than the fact that if a woman would take the pill this way, you'd go from having 13 periods a year to 4, and someone would say, well, that's great, I'm all for that. Are there actual health benefits? Are there reasons other than convenience that a woman might want to think about doing that?
Well, we think that there are. As we watch women, and as it's studied, once these products are released and wider groups of women use them, we will know a little bit more about their health benefits. Absolutely. Control of PMS, and also very importantly, control of endometriosis are probably the two biggest things that we think that women are going to have a benefit from. What we don't really know yet is how good it's going to be as a protection against ovarian cysts. I know over the years we've always touted birth control pills as being a protection against ovarian cysts. But in fact, most birth control pills that are protective against ovarian cysts are the stronger birth control pills, some of which are no longer on the market. So we're seeing a little bit less ovarian cyst protection than we thought we were getting in the past. And it's not really known with these longer cycle pills whether that will be more effective or not. We think maybe, but it's going to take a little bit more time to establish that. We think that there may be other benefits as well. We know that there are a tremendous number of what we call non-contraceptive benefits to the birth control pill, and we've already talked about several, including acne and including control of heavier periods, so less anemia. Those are important, and we'll learn more in the future. Mm. We know there's less ovarian cancer, there's less uterine cancer.
Let me ask one other question, because I think there are some people who have raised some concerns about it, particularly given some of the recent evidence about potential problems of hormonal replacement therapy. And they'd say that by doing that, by putting a woman on pill that way, what you're doing is you are increasing her lifetime load of estrogen. And they are raising this issue, well, are there some potential health effects there that we wouldn't like as a result?
Well, depending on what dose of pill you were on before, the seasonal is low enough in estrogen that the overall lifetime exposure to estrogen percentage-wise is not going to be very different. The other thing is that probably that hormone replacement therapy news that dealt with women in their 60s that were new starts on hormones well into their menopause is probably completely different than birth control pill use. And we don't think that we are going to be increasing any risks. And there's no evidence of that right now. And there have been a number of patients that have been doing this anyway. So probably that is not a concern. They've actually done some studies that also show that you spend less money. Of course, you have less periods, less money on Tampax, Kotex, so forth. So there are a lot of benefits that we really have to watch for and see how the statistics are really going to pan out.
Okay. Well, again, we have here about 15 minutes left, and if there are people who are listening who have questions, you should certainly take the opportunity to call in. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Well, there's some other things you'd like to talk about?
Well, as long as we were just now talking about estrogen replacement therapy, of course, there's more news about Alzheimer's and estrogen, and there's always more news about that. And I know that the Women's Health Initiative study showed that in their group, they weren't seeing Alzheimer's protection. And there's been some publications recently that even talked about more Alzheimer's and estrogen users rather than less. But there are new studies on the direct effect of estrogen on nerve cells and the benefits that these nerve cells then incur from estrogen use. And again, there's more laboratory evidence that estrogen should help protect against Alzheimer's. So it'll be kind of interesting. We're going to have to put that into the whole mix. We know that what we see in the laboratory isn't always what we see in humans, especially since a lot of the brain research in the laboratory is rat brain research, because I'm not volunteering to give a brain biopsy, and I doubt if very many other people are either. But it's interesting because they found these certain compounds that they thought were working to protect nerve cells against the functional changes that cause Alzheimer's. And when they studied these compounds more, they found that the nerve cells were converting these compounds into estrogen, and that what then was causing the beneficial change was estrogen itself. So I think that's pretty fascinating, and I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that.
All right. Well, I think we have another caller here. We'll go to our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about diabetes. I've heard of a new medicine called Amryl, and I was wondering about that because I hadn't heard of that before. So do you know anything about it? What group is it in?
I don't. I was just reading an article with all the different medicines and the different categorizations, and mm-hmm. I didn't commit them to memory. And I know that that there's just been a lot of progress in the over-the-counter, the oral treatment of diabetes. And there are several classes of drugs that are used now. And if one class isn't working for a particular patient, they can use another class. I think they've done a lot more research on how to monitor patients and what to look for to make sure they don't have side effects from these classes of drugs. But beyond that, I don't think I can answer any specific questions about that specific drug.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions, though, are welcome. I know the doctor will do her best. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. Anywhere that signal will travel, that's 800-222-9455. Some other news that you would like to talk about?
Well, yes. I also wanted to talk about a treatment for fibroids. We were talking about using the hysteroscope to treat fibroids, and I didn't really elaborate. And what that usually involves is doing a resection. We classify fibroids as 1, 2, 3, meaning whether they're completely protruding into the cavity of the uterus, partially protruding into the wall of the uterus, or completely contained within the wall. And knowing what type of fibroid, which is something that's diagnosed at the time of ultrasound preoperatively, is it enables us to tell the patients how the treatment's going to work in order to help her decide management. And there's been a lot of excitement in the past couple of years on uterine artery embolization, meaning taking a substance and having a radiologist inject that substance into some of the main arteries near the uterus and having the uterine blood supply essentially block so that the fibroids die off within the uterus. And the disadvantages of those procedures are that, number one, the radiologist usually isn't set up to do longer-term care of the patient, so they have to be turned over to somebody else who didn't do the procedure and doesn't get to bill for the procedure. So I think that's created some internal problems given the way American medicine is set up. The second problem is that it's somewhat of a blind procedure, meaning that the fibroids themselves are never actually biopsied, so that even though the chance of a fibroid being cancerous is only 1 in 30,000, you don't actually get any tissue to confirm that, in fact, it's a fibroid and not something else you're treating. And then lastly, there just aren't very many doctors that do the procedure. So a group of researchers tried to come up with a way to get the best of both worlds. Doctors, gynecologists are very used to using the laparoscope, the belly button telescope type surgery, to look in the pelvis, look at the uterus, and then sometimes use other instruments to excise fibroids from the uterus. And so a group of researchers, I think they were from Japan or Korea. I don't remember exactly. But at any rate, this group of researchers went in and laparoscopically, as well as tried to surgically remove the fibroids they would typically remove, they tied off the blood vessels that were going to the uterus to essentially accomplish surgically what this radiologic procedure would do with the substances they would put into the blood vessels. And they had a lot of success. And in fact, the fibroids that they treated this way did very successfully shrink. And I think that this may be an alternative that the average woman will be able to have in just a few short years as more gynecologists get trained in this technique.
Okay. We have, again, someone on our toll-free line talk with our line number 4. We will go there. Hello.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, could you please talk about fibromyalgia and if there's anything new with it, and then I'll hang up.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Well, fibromyalgia is a disease that has been termed that because it really is just a medical term for the symptoms that a patient might express. So that the symptoms are a general fatigue or soreness to the body's muscles. So thus the term fibro and myalgia meaning achiness. And it really is one of those mysteries of medicine so far. There are actually whole groups of physicians that only treat this condition, and there are other groups of physicians that who literally don't believe that it's anything other than a normal manifestation of the kinds of aches and pains that, that people get through daily life. So there's been a little bit of a controversy. The groups of physicians that treat fibromyalgia feel that it's important to treat the physical symptoms and limitations that the patient is reporting. So most of the treatments are geared towards whatever is wrong with the patient. So if the patient is fairly functional and doesn't have too many days where they're compromised at all, then no treatment is specifically indicated. If the patient is bedridden, then a lot of treatment is indicated to try to get the patient to be able to function normally. And there have literally been dozens of treatments proposed and tried, from diet and other kinds of things to just treatment like pain medicine to control the actual discomfort, or physical therapy to rehabilitate the muscles that then aren't used and therefore get weaker. So it's really something very specialized. As far as I know, there have been no major breakthroughs in the diagnosis or the etiology, and probably what is best for an individual patient is to find a physician who regularly diagnoses and treats this condition, because if you get yourself with a primary care doctor who, you know, isn't really committed to the diagnosis, you're probably not going to get very effective dialogue going.
Hmm. I think this is one of those cases where, at least I think some physicians believe that it's something that's a whole person kind of condition,
right?
And has been, and I don't mean to suggest, although I think probably some people have said they would like to say that it's psychosomatic somehow, that patients are either imagining their symptoms, or not necessarily that they're imagining them, but they have a psychological sort of component. And I think that there are some doctors who are saying, well, in fact, they do kind of have a psychological component, except that we're not saying that you're imagining your symptoms. If you hurt, you hurt. And that it's something that can't simply be treated as if it was a medical disease where you give somebody a pill and say, here, take this pill and you will feel better. It sounds like it's something much more complicated, where you kind of have to look at the whole person, their lifestyle, what's going on, and respond to it in a number of ways, and simply writing a prescription and say, okay, go down to the pharmacy and get this and take it, that's not going to take care of the problem.
Correct. And I think that's a problem from the doctor standpoint as well as the patient standpoint. It can be frustrating to not really be able to put your finger on a specific thing. Your blood pressure's too high. If I give you this pill, it'll lower it. Your sugar's too high. If I give you this pill, it will lower it. It's not really like that. Or your bone's broken, I'm going to just put it in a cast and make it better. It is much more indistinct than that, and long-term, and does often require psychological evaluation. Certainly somebody who hurts for a long enough period of time will get psychologically weaker and potentially develop certain conditions just from the discomfort. But maybe there was something psychological that lent itself to the evolution of the fibromyalgia itself. People just do not know yet.
Yeah. And is it possible that it could actually be something else because of the sort of the difficulty of the symptoms, but because some symptoms do look a little bit like chronic fatigue, for example?
Sure.
Or some of the things that we that are viral conditions that are associated with that, maybe that's in fact what it is.
Maybe
because of the nature of the symptoms being a little bit vague, you can't you can't put your finger on
something. Well, the problem is with, and this is true with chronic fatigue syndrome as well, there are certain viruses that apparently can cause these symptoms in certain individuals, but there are other individuals who report complete health and they function normally, they exercise, they sleep, they do everything completely normally, but when you check their blood, they also show manifestations of viral infections. Mm-hmm. So that then it's hard to understand why, if two people have the same blood diagnosis of a viral condition, why is one person very functional and one person very non-functional? And that's where we kind of lose it with the viral theory. Yeah. But it may be.
Well, I'm sure that there are other cases, too, where you pair people who are carrying things in their body that would make another person sick, and yet they're not.
Right.
And we really don't know why.
They're healthier.
Well, so
maybe
you
it's
think,
that exercise and diet.
It's that general, okay, that general state of health. We're almost to the point we have to finish. Any last thing that you want to mention?
Let's see, not too much new. The only last other thing that I thought I was going to talk about were yeast infections, and I was going to mention this when we were talking about vaginitis, but they have done some new studies showing that people who get recurrent yeast infections very likely may be carrying them in their mouth or even in their colon area, and there's a lot more push for people who come in with chronic yeast infections to get cultures of these other areas that you could perhaps treat and therefore nip the cycle in its bud.
Okay. Well, there we will leave for it this time around with the promise that Dr. Troopin will be back in December and we will do this program again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice in her area. She teaches at the U of I Med School once a month. Always on a Monday, she is here on this program and we talk about women's health.